Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library. Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome to Turn the Page podcast. This is Jessica, and I am sitting here with...
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Shuttle Shaw. I'm president of the Long Island chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, representing 1,500 pediatricians from Brooklyn through Suffolk.
And on the other side, I have...
Hi, I'm Liz Isaacson. I'm the executive director of Docs for Tots. We're a nonprofit here on Long Island that works to connect doctors to community resources and families so that we can improve policies, practices for children 0 to 5.
And joining us on the other line is...
I'm Dr. Perry Klass. I'm a professor of journalism and pediatrics at New York University, and I'm the national medical director of an organization called Reach Out and Read.
Welcome. You are in the right place because reading is where libraries all started, lending books. So I just wanted to jump in with a few questions. First, I mean, obviously, we all think it's important for children to be exposed to books early. Why is it important to read to your child, and how early should new parents start?
Well, I would say that new parents should start as soon as their parents, if not before. And there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, from the time a baby is born, a baby craves the sound of parental voices, craves being talked to, sung to, read to. And reading does two things. It's a way to get that language in there, that storytelling voice, that language-rich interaction between the parent and the child. So that's a great habit to get into. And it's also, speaking of habits, a way of starting to build into your baby's day from the very beginning, those moments when you sit together with a book and you're reading or you're singing or you're telling a story.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And when you really picture a parent reading with a child, what do you picture? You picture them sort of nestled together, sharing an object, having attention to one thing. And that's a very comforting, solid moment for the child. And our world right now is full of so many distractions that starting that habit and that enjoyment that you have together with that child as early as possible and continuing that, reading a book is so much more than literacy. Mm-hmm. It's really about bonding and interacting and sharing a quiet moment.
And from a librarian's point of view, we are taught when you take classes, you know, in library school, if you're doing children's literacy, and I do recommend, you know, if you are into that, that you, you know, even if that's not the direction you go, it's at least one class you take, that it's really important to get your children's hands on a book as early as possible. It's really important to introduce the concept of reading as early as possible. And we always tell parents when they come into the children's room, they're like, oh, I don't know what to eat, where to even start. You know, is it too early? It's never too early. And I can honestly say that having my own children seeing it, they're like having the book is like breathing and it's bonding time and it's really just special. How does early reading promote language development?
Well, we like to talk about the way that young children are sponges, the way that they learn, not because they're formally taught, right? You don't teach babies language the way you teach us as adults another language. You don't line them up in a classroom and give them lessons. But babies, young children learn by absorbing everything that goes on around them. They're picking up a tremendous number of cues and an enormous amount of information from the language that's swirling around them. We know that they learn most from language that's directed at them, interactive language, back and forth. We know also that, unfortunately, they don't learn anything from electronic screen language. Having the TV on in the background or in the foreground, that's not how they learn language. They learn language from back and forth, from what we call in pediatrics serve and return interactions. And so one of the things that you can do with a book is it's a kind of a script. That is to say, if I'm saying I would say this to you as a pediatrician, we all say this, find ways to talk to your baby, right? When you dress your baby, that's when you do the, there are your toes, there's your knee, oh, there's your nose. And that's one way to get a lot of language into your daily life. But then there's the sitting together and showing the baby a story and pointing and saying, look, there's a dog. Oh, there's a big dog. The dog goes woof. And one of the things that we emphasize in Reach Out and Read when we talk to pediatricians about how to talk to parents about reading is that reading to a newborn or a young baby is not necessarily about reading your way through a story. It's about using the book as a kind of a prompt to talk about things that are in the baby's world, parts of the body, food, all of the things which promote different words. One of the things we know, and this is true for all of us, whether we're highly educated, whoever we are as parents, we've got pretty good studies to show that we all use richer language when there's a book in the picture. We use more words. We use more complicated syntax. Books just bring out the best in us in terms of language, and our children are exposed to this. And this is a point Liz was making earlier. Think about what it's like when you're reading with a baby or a young child. It's kind of skin to skin. You're in contact. You're looking at each other, or you're looking at the same thing together. It's a very warm, loving, safe context for the baby to be introduced both to books and to the language of books and storytelling.
I have a question for both Dr. Isaacson and Dr. Klass. When I'm reading to a child, to what extent does the theater of it play a role in terms of language development? Obviously, there's the interactional piece of it. There's the serve and return, the asking questions. But is there a difference between doing and reading the book to your child where you start flipping in between different voices of the different characters or asking questions about the illustrations as opposed to going through the actual text and maybe asking a few questions about the text? Is the extra effort to sort of create the cinema or the theater around the story helpful from a socio-emotional or language standpoint?
I think that's a great question. Part of it, I would say, is if you're enjoying it, that's your child's going to pick up on your pleasure. There's a purely entertainment aspect, which is only good. But it's also true that, and by the way, what you were just talking about, what Dr. Shah was just explaining is kind of the advanced stage, that is to say, using the big, deep voice for the bear or the little squeaky voice for the mouse. And if you haven't been read to yourself, that may not be second nature. It's one of the reasons it's kind of a great thing if you can get to the library, say,
yes,
to a story time, if you can hear somebody else read a story and see how much fun that is, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, when we do story times here, it's always important to emote and to sort of, because it's not really a one-on-one, a story time is almost like it's not the one-on-one sharing with parents, but I would recommend parents to take their children to a story time because it promotes many different things such as, sitting and listening in a group and, patience, because sometimes you call on the different children as to what they understand, they sort of are exchanging ideas, but also, you as a librarian reading to children, you have to enjoy it because they know if you're not. And if you're willing to put yourself out there and do the big voices and, oh, you know, the wolf and make the sound of the wind, they're going to be more engaged in especially a story time, in a story time setting.
So I would totally agree. I think that community, library-hosted, toddler times, and early childhood times, it's just one of many tools. Dr. Klass really did a good job pointing that earlier, that singing songs, talking to your children as they're getting their diaper changed, going to story hour, and reading books at night, it's all part of a lots of different pieces that come together to help a child attain language. When I think about how to read a book to a child, I really like to encourage parents to trust themselves and to know that there's probably no wrong way to do it. Because there are certain personalities where taking on a big voice or taking on a baby's voice, like I can tell you right now, my husband is never going to do that. But he was very good at reading books with our kids. He just did it in his way. And he enjoyed doing that. And they knew he enjoyed doing that. So there's really no wrong way to go about it. If you love to read a manual, you could probably read a manual to a kid as long as you are willing to share your joy with
them.
Exactly.
And that is the important point, sharing your joy. Absolutely. I know I have some good friends who've gone into children's entertainment, and they did a workshop for librarians. And the big thing that they said, that's not there. So that's a very, very good point.
So I do think that's absolutely right. There's no wrong way. But I also think that it's helpful for parents to know that the objective is not to have the kids sit quietly and listen to a whole long story. And that anything, whatever your style, anything you can do to make it a little more back and forth, a little more interactive, is probably going to help pull the child in. And of course, I've seen expert librarians do that where they'll have the whole chorus of children responding, you know, should he open the door? No, no, don't open the door, right? But any back and forth, what's this, what's that, what's the dog, you know, what does the dog say? Or, of course, as children get older, we all know what happens if you read to a two-year-old and you take a familiar story and you change one of the words, right? Because the two-year-old will make you read the same book over and over again every night. And if you vary it in any tiny respect, the two-year-old will shriek with fury. And many parents enjoy doing this and tormenting their two-year-olds
and
playing this game.
And the two-year-old says, no!
Right.
Yeah, I agree. I actually, you know, thinking about Reach Out and Read, Perry, is they do a fabulous job when they have their program in pediatrician offices where they're handing out books to families, of giving that guidance on what to expect at what age. Because obviously a six-month-old is probably going to take that board book and put it into their mouth very quickly. And that's okay, and it's accepted, right? And then by the time a child's 3, 4, if you're reading often, they'll definitely be able to sit through a book. So it's that kind of information for parents helps them build success. And I think Reach Out and Read does a really good job in conveying that information in a timely manner.
I'm also going to plug our local librarians as a resource.
Thank you.
Because I will say that I think that reading and which books you choose are very much influenced by the books that we were read to. And I think that's why there are certain books that just span generations, because our parents read them to us, and then we are reading them to our children, and then hopefully they will read them to their children. But the panorama of books that are now available at all levels of reading is really amazing. And that is something that I personally didn't know, because I was relying on just experience. The types of stories and the richness of these stories. And as these kids get older, the ability to choose a really age-appropriate story guided by the Reach Out and Read handout, but paired with the local librarian who know our kids, right? They know what things our kids like. And if they even ask them a couple of things about what our kids like, they can find a story about a detective or a dog or an animal or a zoo.
Or a dog detective at a zoo.
Yeah.
I'm
well,
sure that exists.
I mean, that's always been the hope with Reach Out and Read, is that, you know, if the parent comes in and says, if I have to read that farm animal book one more time, I'm, you know, going to either throw the book out the window, or that we could sort of say, go to the library, say farm animals, see what else they can do for you, right? Once you've got a child's expression of interest, or whether it's a topic or a kind of a story, right, those resources are out there, and there's guidance and there's help. I mean, I'd be curious to hear what I bet there's also a lot of expertise on the part of the librarians when you're working with parents who maybe were not read to themselves, want to do this, but aren't quite sure how to choose age-appropriate books for young children.
Yeah, I agree. And you know what? We get reviews of new books. We look at the new books all the time. And it's also, it becomes very personal. I know the term book curator is en vogue now, but we're the original book curators. You know, we get to, and Dr. Shah, I've seen his children grow up. We get to know these children and these families. And it's like, you know, the more we're able to interact with them, it becomes a personalized experience.
So I love the interaction between Reach Out and Read and the library. I think that's a key connection that needs to be made at the community level. And I just want to give a couple plugs for things that are happening that I've experienced here in Nassau County, working with Docs for Tots around libraries. So Docs for Tots runs a program called Help Me Grow Long Island, and we promote developmental screening. We've actually hosted 4 different developmental screening events at different libraries where parents come and we help them administer developmental screening, and then we have activities for the children to do in the meantime. And recently we worked with Renee McGrath from the Nassau County Association of Libraries.
She's a youth services liaison for Nassau Library System, which is central to work we do at all the Nassau libraries.
So she was a great partner with us, and she had received a small grant to increase children's reading at birth. And we were able to work with a number of different partners, pull together a bag, get some free books, get some information, and then call our partners at 3 of the Women, Infant, and Child Nutrition Centers, or what we call WIC centers, that serve low-income families across Nassau County, and distribute over 1,000 bags when the parents come in for their first visit to WIC. And so that's the kind of activities that are happening in Long Island to really connect the dots. And, you know, having a young child in the house can be very isolating. And when you've discovered the library, it really helps with the isolation. And so this connection of reading from home to library to community helps a child develop not just literacy and language, but really helps their entire broad development. We can't underscore that enough. It's not just reading, it's everything else too.
I certainly agree. And, you know, a lot of us, we have a lot of hands-on activities. We have playrooms, and, you know, we always have the board books in our playroom. So no matter how young your child is, if you think that they're going to tear the books apart, there's always the board books in our playroom. So I want to talk a little bit about early reading and bilingual families. Is early reading better for bilingual families? Should it be done in both languages?
So the important thing about reading, which is also the important thing about talking, is that you do it. So you should be doing it in whatever language you're most comfortable doing it in. Small children have astonishing brains. Any adult who's listening who has tried seriously to learn a second language should have a really healthy respect for the brain of a 1-year-old or a 2-year-old, which can learn unaccented, perfectly grammatical languages in a way that as adults we just study and struggle as we might, cannot do. So what they need is they need to hear language. If you're going to talk and sing, if you've got two that you're comfortable in, great. But if you've got one where you're really able to talk complex sentences, big vocabulary, comfortable reading, use that one. The language centers of the child's brain will be stimulated. The child will learn that language on a complex level, and that the sort of level of sophistication, the vocabulary, the syntax development of that first language will help the child master the second language when it comes. So with Reach Out and Read, what we've tried very hard to do, we do give out bilingual books because families enjoy those tremendously. And sometimes you'll give a bilingual book and a parent will say to you very proudly, I'm going to read the Vietnamese, but his older brother is in third grade and he's going to read the English, or grandma's going to practice with the English. That's fine. But if people are more comfortable reading, storytelling, talking in another language, the stimulation to the brain, the language, the back and forth, that's what really matters most.
Thank you. Does anybody else want to weigh in on that?
Is there a concern, and this is a question for both Dr. Isaacson and Dr. Klass, is there a concern that if the child is exposed to both languages early on, that there's the opportunity for confusion, which might impact them when they get to preschool? I say this because when I was growing up in the way, way, way distant past, there was a concern that if you heard one language on the playground and another language at home, that there was the chance that you might come into school delayed for age in English, and that there was a concern that that might sort of label you early on in kindergarten.
So there is still a common conception that someone can be language delayed in English going into school. But honestly, when we're assessing someone's language ability, we should be assessing it in both languages and understand that over time they will even out. So I think it's sometimes harder for us adults to understand than for the kids to understand that they are able to learn two languages at once. It may not always look so clean to us, but that's okay. And it's our job to be patient with them. I don't know, Perry, if you have a better explanation.
No, I think that's absolutely right. It's something people did used to worry about. But children who are growing up truly bilingual, children who are actually learning two languages at once, they may have slightly smaller vocabularies at a given age in one language or the other. But on the other hand, when you look at the vocabularies they've got in both languages together, they're doing astonishingly well. And similarly, they may do some kind of code switching early on in which it's not absolutely sure that they get the right, they keep the languages completely separate, but they absolutely will, and they'll get it right, and they'll do it early. And I think that one of the things that we sort of have to realize when we're looking at children who are learning two languages is that, again, the more stimulation, the more they hear, the more complicated language they hear, the better. So if, for example, you have a parent who is fluent and comfortable in first language and in English becomes much more inhibited, much more limited vocabulary, that parent should be talking, reading, singing in the language in which the complicated words and ideas and thoughts are coming through. And the kids will do well. We need to support them and help them, just as Liz said.
Yeah. I will say that we work a lot with early care and education providers. We work a lot with pre-Ks, and that myth still exists. So, I think parents that are addressing this issue currently need to stay informed, talk to their doctor about it, really stay on top of it and make sure that they're advocating for their dual language learner.
This is very interesting, and I think an important thing to talk about because we have so many languages. Syosset alone is a very diverse community. I believe there's many languages spoken here.
Oh, if you walk through the Syosset Public Library or pretty much any library in Nassau County, you will hear English, you will hear Spanish, you will hear Hindi, you will hear Urdu, you will hear French, you will hear Marathi, you'll hear
Korean,
Japanese,
yeah.
Mandarin, Cantonese. It's a whole panoply of languages.
And it's certainly, you know, there are a lot of families who are dual language families, and a lot of times the first place they come is the library. There's so many parents, and they'll say, this was our first stop. We just moved here. This was our first stop. We got our library cards. We got our kids' library cards. So I'm glad we're having this conversation. What's the neuroscience evidence behind early reading? Perry, so I'm going to pass this one to you.
Okay, so let's start with what we know about babies' brains. We know that when babies are first born, the actual connections between the nerve cells in the brain are relatively sparse. That's to say, the cells are all there, but they're not tremendously connected up, and that over the first couple of years of life, there's an incredible proliferation of those synapses, those connections between the nerve cells, so that a 2-3-year-old baby has a wildly interconnected brain with all kinds of multidirectional complicated networks forming. And that we also know that after that, there's what we call a pruning, just as you would say in the garden, in which the connections that the child doesn't use drop away and you lose them. So one of the things we know is that the environmental exposures around a baby and a toddler, a child in those preschool years, play a tremendously important role in actually determining the structure of your brain, which connections you keep, which pathways you keep. And you can see this in a bunch of different ways. For example, every newborn, or almost every newborn, is essentially capable of making all of the sounds of every language, right? We know this. If you take a baby from one culture and at birth that baby's adopted into another culture, the baby will grow up speaking the language that the baby hears, whatever the sounds are. But we also know that by around a year, you stop recognizing and reacting to the sounds that aren't in your language. And there are all kinds of really interesting studies, both about the ways that babies recognize or don't recognize different sounds according to which language they're hearing, or even different patterns of your lip formation, because babies are not only listening to the sounds, they're also looking at your face and reading your lips. And so babies who are accustomed to hearing English, for example, notice the difference, even if they're looking at a silent video, if somebody switches to French. And again, if you're growing up bilingual, you keep the ability to recognize all these cues. If you're growing up in a monolingual setting, you lose a lot of these networks because you don't need to recognize the difference between the lip patterns of English and the lip patterns of French. These are studies that were, say, done in Quebec or in parts of Canada where children were hearing both English and French. So the baby brain is phenomenal. There all of these patterns develop, and the environment, the richness of the language environment, what we sometimes call the language soup in which young babies grow up, actually plays a role in determining the structure of that brain, which the child is going to take forward into school, or if you prefer, which is going to take the child forward into school.
Thank you so much. That's all extremely fascinating.
No, I was going to say, and to take it even a little bit, broader, when we were talking at the beginning of this broadcast, talking about how important it is for that solid moment about a child being in the comforting arms of their parents and reading. It's not just the neural connections, obviously, that occur with language. That is obviously extremely important. But it's also all of the associations that are made with that story. I think all of us can think of a story that was read to us as children. And we remember not just the story itself, but we remember the memory of where we are and where we were when we had those stories read to us. And I think that that's also an extremely important part, because even when you're decades removed from that, because that memory is so strong, when you hear that story, or if you're prompted in the correct way, you wind up reliving that sense of comfort as if it had just happened. So I think that speaks to the power of the early memory that's created as a consequence of all of these neural connections being strengthened early on in development.
So what are the economic impacts of early reading? Would anybody like to go first? Liz?
Sure. I think it's hard to say exactly what the economic impacts of early reading are. And I think we need to say early reading to our children, because sometimes in our society there seems to be a big push to have kids to read early. And what we're talking about today is not having children learning to read early,
reading to your children
but
early.
Instead, reading to our children early, at a young age.
And that's, I think, a really important point to make.
Yeah, and it's the reading, and I love what Perry just said, the language soup, and that whole language soup that a child is exposed to early on. We know that their language acquisition and how much vocabulary and language and perhaps recognition of letters and those things that they're having as they're entering school can predict further school success. And success in school leads to later success. You know, third grade reading scores, whatever you want to talk about. But we know that we're giving them the tools that they're able to learn to read efficiently and proficiently, then they're more likely to lead to a successful life. So that's the economic return ultimately. I would like to say that there's also an interaction from the health perspective, right? So health and education are intricately intertwined, right? So it's hard to learn if you're not healthy. And the healthier you are, the better you'll learn. But also, the more you learn, the healthier you'll be as you age. So it's an interaction that starts very early on and continues through the rest of our life. So I think that the real economic impact of us reading to our children from very early onward makes them ready for school. And that readiness for school leads to greater lifetime success.
And I just also wanted to add, because we've talked about it before, when you're discussing just success and education, when you're talking about the interaction that happens during reading, that's early critical thinking. I mean, that's a connection that is extremely important, just being able to make that if then, you know, what happens with this? Well, this is the outcome. That's a really important thing that the child is learning.
Yeah, I think that's important also for policymakers who are trying to decide where to allocate funds. You know, we obviously live in a world of finite resources, so we always have to decide where we're putting our time, where we're putting our effort, and where we're putting our finances. But it's also important to realize that people don't think of it in the same way, I think, that we do, but early reading to your child is actually a public health strategy. In the same way that car seats are a public health strategy, in the same way that immunizations are a public health strategy, in the same way that avoiding secondhand smoke is a public health strategy. And I think that's part of the reason you see a group of pediatricians coming together to talk about the importance of early reading, and organizations like Reach Out and Read layering the importance of early reading onto the pediatric visits, because the cost of a book relative to the cost of a child not achieving their full potential is absolutely insignificant.
Well, you've all spoken so eloquently and beautifully on this point that I feel as a pediatrician, I just need to say a word about the teachers, the valiant, heroic, wonderful teachers who actually take on the work of helping children learn to decode print. And that part of what you're doing as a parent when you're reading, starting very early, I mean, and you do this all just by having fun and by the back and forth and by everything we've been talking about. But part of what your child is coming away with is some very specific skills, which we can talk about, which come with being read to. But part of it is what was mentioned before, is just that association of books with a good time, with feeling secure, with being held by the person you love most in the world, and hearing the voice you associate with that person. And then if you're a teacher and you're helping children take on that kind of difficult, complicated, repetitive job of learning how to decode print, which even for children with their brains, which are better than our brains, is a hard job, it's so much easier for you as a teacher if the children in the room look at the book and they think, oh yes, books, those are fun. You get information, you get stories. When I look at a book, I think of being in my mother's lap, my father's lap, my grandma's lap. We're helping the teachers do what they're doing because we're helping the children understand what the point is.
Thank you. I agree 100%. Liz, did you want to add to that?
No, I think that was perfect. Summed it up very nicely.
So are there any types of books from a medical standpoint that, because I know as a librarian we have our own, you know, views of this, but are there any types of books that you feel from a medical standpoint are better at certain early ages?
So what we would say about the early ages is you don't want too many words on the page. You want, for very young children, familiar objects. Whether it's parts of the body or babies doing things or things that you might see around the house or animals. And then as children get a little older, they're more interested in, say, more exotic animals or concepts, colors and numbers. We stress rhyming because helping kids understand how language works, how words work, why things rhyme. We stress humor. Everybody likes, including the parent, likes a book better if it's a little funny. We stress repetition. That two-year-old who wants the book the same way every time, she's going to want to join in on the chorus. She's going to want, you're going to read the book, and instead of coming, I know some fun games, said the cat, and you'll stop, and she'll say, in the hat, right? You want the repetition, the rhyme. The Cat in the Hat is a good example of a book that rhymes, that has repetition, and that's funny. And you want, and but then in the end, the other truth, and I'm going to say this both as a mother and as a pediatrician, is, and we talked about this before when we were talking about librarians and all they know, is you want the book that the child wants. And if you, I have a child who, one of my children who has what we call in the trade the truck gene. And as a child, any book about trucks, no matter how excruciatingly tedious, was the book he wanted. And we had a huge pile of excruciatingly tedious truck books. And I have no strong interest in trucks, but I read truck books over and over again because there was just nothing as fascinating as a truck book. It could have been dinosaurs, it could have been horses, it could have just been some particular book, which was the book. And that was what created those reading moments.
I agree. And we are also taught in these early, you know, when we take our classes for MLS, that repetition is an early literacy skill. And I can tell you, for both as a librarian and a mother, it is absolutely true. 100%. It might drive you crazy to read, I don't know, that pigeon book a million times, but your child is learning. It is definitely an early literacy skill. So let that pigeon drive the bus, or just read the book about the pigeon driving the bus. So before we close out, does anybody have anything to add?
No, it was a pleasure being here, talking with you at the Syosset Library.
It was really wonderful. And once again, the organizations that you...
Sure. So
yeah.
This is Liz Isaacson from Docs for Tots.
This is Perry Klass from Reach Out and Read.
This is Shuttle Shaw from the Long Island chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics.
And this is Jessica from Syosset Library. And I am going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.